This is an ABC podcast.
Shame and guilt are social emotions that we feel bad because we think that other people would think badly of us. They're sort of a way of preventing ourselves from doing bad things. They're also a way of punishing ourselves for having done bad things.
Dr. Alex Korb from UCLA, and more from him later about the brain in shame. Hi, it's All in the Mind on RN. I'm Lynn Malcolm. Today, how the social emotion of shame plays out in today's society, both at a personal and public level.
Shame on you. You have given all women a bad name. You're just a piece of shit.
An ancient, almost barbaric punishment has returned out there in the vast, crowded emptiness of the virtual world. The punishment is shame. Nowadays, it arrives unannounced, and when it does, you will find out what it means to be alone and vulnerable.
A disgraced pop science writer called Joan Allera. He'd been caught plagiarizing and faking quotes, and he was drenched in shame and regret, he told me. And he had the opportunity to publicly apologize at a foundation lunch. Maybe it would win him some salvation. He knew before he arrived that the foundation was going to be live streaming his event, but what he didn't know until he turned up was that they'd erected a giant screen Twitter feed right next to his head. And here were some of the tweets that were cascading into his eyeline as he was trying to apologize. Joan Allera boring us into forgiving him. And Joan Allera has not proven that he is capable of feeling shame. And Joan Allera is just a frigging sociopath. That last word, it's a very human thing to do, to dehumanize the people we hurt. It's because we want to destroy people, but not feel bad about it.
And last tonight, a case of what seems to us to be serial plagiarism. You're almost certainly familiar with Dr. Tanvir Ahmed. In a recent column about narcissism, Dr. Ahmed wrote of
the timeless human desire for attention and admiration.
Well, actually, most of that phrase, and indeed almost a quarter of that column, was lifted from a five-year-old article in The New Atlantis. Even more came from a four-year-old article in The New York Times. I'm afraid it doesn't look to us as though these examples are uncharacteristic.
Jonathan Holmes on ABC TV's Media Watch in 2012, when it was first discovered that Bangladeshi-born Australian psychiatrist Tanvir Ahmed was found to have committed plagiarism in his writings for the Sydney Morning Herald. 3 years later, whilst writing for the Australian newspaper, further incidents of plagiarism were revealed, which led to his sacking. Well, since then, having been shamed publicly for his misdemeanours, Tanvir Ahmed has thought more about this emotion and has just released a new book called In Defence of Shame.
Coming from a Muslim Bangladeshi background, and I guess a lot of ethnic groups, we're effectively a shame-based culture. And I think when I was growing up, I looked at this notion of shame, which in my language is called lodja, L-A-J-J-A. And there's actually a famous book with that title by a physician, Taslima Nasreen, and she wrote it in the 90s. And I remember that even that word, she became very infamous because there was a fatwa placed upon her by Islamic clerics and she had to flee. And I actually visited Bangladesh around then. So I became very interested in the term, and it was a term I'd heard all my life. And I used to see it very negatively because it was really associated with, you know, things like honour killing, gossip, intense conformity, ostracism, and I saw it as almost a prison, and I couldn't see any positives of it.
You talked about your background. Perhaps it explains some of your early personal memories of being shamed, just to illustrate that emotion.
As humans, we have something called self-conscious emotions, and the typical ones are guilt, shame is another one, humiliation is another one, embarrassment is another one. They all need a degree of self-consciousness. We have to be aware of other people, that we're being perceived by other people. And they also require what's known as a cognitive capacity. We need to have a kind of rational basis. We need to be able to think and have a degree of self-awareness. So different cultures become aware of shame at different ages. I was aware of it early on, probably from punishment. So physical punishment was quite common. I remember something, what feels humorous now, a typical shaming punishment for me was I used to have to hold my ears and do multiple squats when I did something that might have warranted punishment. And I remember that distinctly. And it came back to me quite recently while I was finishing up this book, because I saw it on some BBC News coverage, and there was coverage in Delhi where the policemen were grabbing people who weren't socially distancing and they're lining them up to perform these squats. And I found it very humorous, and it certainly reminded me of my own childhood. But that's an example of a shaming type punishment. And the difference, what shame is about, is one, it's about an audience transgressing some sort of boundary, but a sense of a group. And that varies from guilt, because guilt doesn't necessarily have a sense of a group. It's more about having an internal set of values, and it's almost a private emotion. The other aspect of shame, that it's what psychologists call global attribution. And by that, I mean, when we have a specific task, let's say we're not very good at fractions doing maths. So a specific attribution is, okay, well, I need to practice fractions more. I'm not good at this aspect of maths. Where a global attribution may go, well, you're just not very intelligent. You're just not very smart. So that's a global attribution. So an aspect of shame is there's an association with a more global attribution related to the self. And that's a key difference between shame and guilt, this notion of an audience and a global attribution.
Tanvir Ahmed reflects on his own experience of being publicly shamed several years ago for plagiarism.
Yeah, so initially I had a side activity writing while I was a psychiatrist at the same time. And I basically had journalistic failures where I was accused of plagiarism. And essentially, look, I did essentially not attribute aspects of my columns in the Sydney Morning Herald. And to be frank, I certainly knew it was wrong, but I don't think I took it terribly seriously. And it was the time sort of the internet was blowing up. And I definitely made those errors.
What sort of an emotion did you feel then? What was the shame like for you then?
To be frank, I probably felt more of an embarrassment, because it didn't feel like it was some sort of grand strategy. And it was almost like I was exposed and I felt a bit stupid. And I thought, oh, okay. But I think I was lucky then too. I mean, one, I had a thoroughly solid job as a psychiatrist, which was unaffected. But also, I think I felt a lot of support then. I did feel like a lot of people sort of came out supporting me. They're like, look, just don't do it again, blah, blah. And this is why when it happened to me again, and that really was a clumsy error. And I'd argue it was certainly little intention that second time. And I think it was more a marker of past bad habits. And it was also a bit of an attack. So it was also people who didn't like a view of mine, who then hunted down looking for errors. And unfortunately, I offered them rather easily. To be honest, that's when I really felt shame. Even though when the error was probably more minor, that's when I really felt like I let lots of people down. And where there was lots of supporters, people giving you another go. And as you know, Lynn, I mean, media's a tough game. Opportunities are scarce. So when people put themselves on the line and given me more opportunities, and you really feel like a real sense of failure, letting people down. And there's obviously that public component, and those sort of errors are magnified in the public lens. And not only are they magnified, there's a new aspect of modern shame, which is this what I call the digital mark or the digital shadow. And that has overlaps with marks that may have been left in shame, say in medieval times. There might have been a mark on the body or some sort of clothing. And I think that has affected me, again, probably much less seriously than some other people. And I think that's a new aspect of shame that I certainly have personal experience with.
Dr. Tanvir Ahmed, author of In Defence of Shame. You're with All in the Mind on RN. I'm Lynn Malcolm. Shame is a social emotion which plays out both in the public and the personal realm. So what is happening in the brain when one feels shame? Dr. Alex Korb, neuroscientist from UCLA.
Part of the social emotions involve the medial prefrontal cortex, which is the part of the brain that is responsible for understanding other people's perspectives and minds. Like, if I do something that I don't think you're going to have a problem with, then I'm not going to feel guilty or ashamed. Whereas if a guy do something that I know that you're going to be upset with, but you know, I'm kind of self and I want to do it anyway, it's my ability to understand what you are going to think of my actions that sort of dictates whether I'm going to feel guilty or ashamed about that. And so humans have a remarkable capacity to mind read and be able to understand, predict the thoughts of everyone around them and the people that we interact with. It's just that a lot of times we're so good at it that we think we're perfect at it. And so when guilt and shame become a problem is when we do something that we think everyone's going to be so mad and upset with us if they knew. We don't want them to know. But in actuality, maybe that's wrong. Maybe that's just our assumption about how everyone else would think about us. But if they actually knew, they wouldn't really care that much, or they would be compassionate towards us. One of the most interesting elements, though, I think about guilt and shame came from this study that I looked at where they stuck people in an fMRI machine, which looks at their brain activity while people do a variety of tasks. And in this case, the task they had them do was think about events that had happened or actions they had taken that they felt guilty or ashamed. And they compared that with neutral events or actions that they had taken that you felt proud of. And they found that, not surprisingly, pride, things that you're proud of, activated the reward centers of the brain. But when they looked at guilt and shame, that also activated the reward centers in the brain. And that really surprised me. But the more I thought about it, the more it started to make sense, because the hardest thing for the brain to accept, and really the emotional circuits in the brain to accept, is lack of control, that sometimes bad things happen for no reason. So if you take an action and something bad happens as a consequence, it is very unsettling to think like, oh, well, that would have happened anyway, or that was just an accident, I couldn't have done anything about it. And that's very unsettling, and it feels calming almost to blame yourself. Like, I don't know, that was my fault, because it's a way of asserting control over an uncontrollable world. Like if you got in a car accident and injured someone, you might feel this wave of shame. But like, if you thought about it, like, well, what else would you have done differently? Oh, if I just hadn't, you know, turned the radio at that time, and you could just feel this intense, you know, guilt and shame for these like little tiny things. But it is unhelpful sometimes because we blame ourselves over and over again in order to get a sense of control over the world. But that can get us stuck. If you can learn to move past that and not sort of fall into that sort of addictive pattern and learn to accept that sometimes bad things happen and you don't have control over it, then it can help you move forward.
So you're suggesting that you can become addicted to feeling guilty or to feeling shame because of the reward system. So how difficult is it to kick that addiction?
Well, it sort of depends on the type of brain that you have, because some people's brains are more emotional and they're more emotionally reactive. And it depends on how your social circuits have developed and your levels of self-criticism and your levels of criticism of other people and what the people around you are like. Because if you are a very forgiving and compassionate person towards yourself and towards others, then it's usually easier to overcome feelings of guilt and shame, because you sort of tend to assume that, oh, other people will be forgiving of me and I'm forgiving of myself, and then we can sort of move past that. If you are very self-critical and critical of others as well, and you sort of expect perfection, then it can be very hard to break out of and move past, because you're like, I expect this of myself and I let myself down and other people should expect this, and I'm not going to suddenly just go easy on myself because then I'll start making mistakes all the time. And in that way, it can sort of be very hard to break out of. And that's why one of the most important skills for people to practice is self-compassion. It can increase negative feelings sometimes when we treat ourselves more compassionately, but it helps us over time to break out of that sort of shame, guilt spiral.
Dr. Alex Korb, author, coach, and neuroscientist from UCLA. And to learn more about the brain, you can subscribe to Dr. Korb's newsletter, and we'll link to it on the All in the Mind website. Australian psychiatrist Tanvir Ahmed sees that the emotion of shame is more relevant today than ever in relation to psychiatric disorders and other areas of mental illness.
One way of thinking about shame, Lynn, is it's often related to social subordination. So I think there's a host of disorders where it is often about social avoidance and feelings of social subordination. And an argument I'm making is that I think it's relatively unique in the modern era, partly because we live in a media-rich, social media knitted together meritocracy. And one of the disorders I talk about, social anxiety, I think, A, we have arguably higher levels of that than we've ever had before, because in a service economy, there's much more focus on self-presentation. There's much more need to kind of interact with other human beings and kind of sell yourself, if you like. But also, I think social media often heightens comparison, and much has been said about that. So there, historically, shame's often been about a failure to do one's duty. But an argument I'm making is in a modern media-rich meritocracy, shame is often about feeling unlovable or not having adequately achieved, at least in your mind. There's a moral dimension of that that takes place when we live in a meritocracy. So I think social anxiety is a modern form of shame where people become very avoidant, are very fearful of negative scrutiny and feel like they need to subordinate socially, and they do so via avoidance. And I think that's an epidemic in our society. Another arena that I talk about is self-harm. I think underneath self-harm, when you examine people with self-harm, and there's been a huge rise in self-harm in the last two decades. Now, part of that may be measurement, and it's certainly more common in women and amongst adolescents. But when you examine people self-harming, Lynn, what's often going is an intolerability of negative emotions. There's this feeling that they just can't tolerate sort of anger, aggression, and it's essentially internalized onto the self. And that's often what self-harm is about. Now, there's no question many of them had traumatic backgrounds or conflicted households. So there's no question there's a developmental component, but there's often a strong element of shame. And this is where I also argue that in a culture that elevates positivity so much, there may also be something in the culture that contributes to our higher rates of self-harm. Finally, I'd also add post-traumatic stress disorder. I think there's often huge amounts of shame there where people have suffered some sort of major trauma. They can't always make sense of it, partly because we increasingly lack a language to deal with those kind of extreme adversity of suffering. So when you have an entirely medical language to deal with catastrophe, sometimes it's not adequate. And then they become very avoidant. They can't face the world. They can't emotionally connect. And underneath of that is that element of social subordination, which is very closely linked to shame. And to be honest, I'd actually almost say this in the last 6-12 months, Lynn, as I've been writing this book, and I've actually been challenging more people to think about these terminology, and I found it very powerful. So in some ways, I found the book myself therapeutic. So there's obviously that personal dimension, both in my professional work, both as a journalist, but also as a psychiatrist, whereas I've found it extremely powerful with my own patients.
Shame seems to have a very big regulating type effect on society at the moment. Can you talk a bit about in what particular areas we're really seeing shame being used as a way of perhaps regulating society?
So shame is very important in probably three different areas we use it. One is group behaviour, regulating groups, and that could be professional groups, it could be social groups. Another is regulating what we might consider primitive emotions. It could be aggression, anger, disgust, and that will have a cultural component. For example, table manners, that is a typical thing that might happen in Western societies where much of the world won't regulate table manners as intensely. Another aspect that happens at an individual level where we set certain standards and boundaries on ourselves. And when we don't reach them, we might feel shame then, particularly if we see the mistakes, again, in terms of global attribution. I think what we're seeing at the moment, we're going through a period in history where the group morality is up for grabs. Not only do we live in very diverse societies in places like Australia, particularly major cities, we've got all manner of groups, cultural groups, professional groups, generational groups. And you've also had the decline of the traditional regulators of morality, be it religion, be it nationalism, even communities and families, in a kind of much more anonymous sort of urban living that most of us are in. So arguably, we're at a time in history where morality and value systems are up for grabs. So you're getting these kind of aspects of shaming, particularly in social media, and social media can magnify shaming, can scale shaming like never before.
Can you give me an example of that?
At the moment, it's happening very much on political correctness grounds, often, where people say something that might be deemed errant regarding, say, race, gender, or other views on the political platform. And I guess one aspect of my book is trying to think about what is healthy forms of shaming. And I think one thing that's coming out at the moment, we're seeing an aspect of shame that is not so healthy. If we think about healthy shame, I think healthy shame depends on having an automatic component of reintegration, where there may be an element of stigma, a brief period of stigma, but even as part of the shaming, there's almost an automatic attempt at reintegrating people into whatever group that they might be being shamed against. But at the moment, what we're really seeing is shame with retribution, but then a lesser of an outlet, no real attempts at reintegrating, and arguably in modern terms, a kind of a tougher realm to reintegrate. Again, with the combination of the internet and social media and activism there, arguably it's getting harder and harder to reintegrate.
So what's an illustration of that that's happening at the moment that you're referring to? What's a particular illustration of that?
A great example is Black Lives Matter. You know, you've had examples where a football player at the LA Galaxy lost his job because his wife sent a tweet around Black Lives Matter where she said Black Nikes Matter, and it was related to the looting that happened. But that's an example of the measures being used to shame are getting looser and looser, not even being applied to the individual. You can be just loosely attached. I mean, he may well find another job. I mean, he's obviously a high-level player, and lesser people with lesser talent may have a similar experience and then find it extremely hard. So you're getting these disproportionate punishments, I think, that combination of shaming and social media is allowing for.
And Tanvir suggests that shaming can be an effective tool to prompt societal change in areas where there are no current legal restrictions.
So shame is often used when there is some decision by a certain group that someone has crossed the boundary somewhere, but there may not be a traditional legal recourse. And I think sometimes that is quite useful. And I'll give you some examples where it can be useful, particularly in the corporate sphere. If you think of, say, factories, fashion factories with outsourcing their manufacturing to places like Indonesia, Bangladesh, which is my ancestry, shaming there regarding wages and condition were very powerful. And it was an example where what they were doing was perfectly legal within the global system. But the public shaming helped them come down to some higher standards, more conducive to what the consumers in the West wanted. I mean, that's not always going to be appropriate. A more recent example, I'd say, Lynn, I think the Hayne Royal Commission was actually an example of a gentle, useful form of shaming for the financial sector, where the financial sector had arguably set their own set of values, had a shared morality or a shared set of values that was getting increasingly distant from the wider community. And those shared set of values was almost entirely about dollars. Like, if you're able to make dollars, even if it was unethical, that was deemed okay almost to some extent. But Hayne was an example of where there was this period of stigma, but now essentially that whole system has been reintegrated and deemed very essential. And arguably they are behaving better on many grounds, given banks are, you know, giving a lot of reprieve regarding interest rates, et cetera. So that may be an example of where corporations and boards can't really feel shame. Individuals need to feel shame. it's also an area where fines haven't really worked. It's a good example where useful shame is a short period of stigma and then reintegration and ideally in an improvement in behaviour.
The title of your book is In Defence of Shame. How do you suggest that we start seeing shame as a positive thing and using it as a positive thing in society? How can we save ourselves from going down this destructive path with shame?
Yeah, I think people need to be aware. Anytime there's an element of shaming, be it at a public level or even at an individual level, I think immediately there needs to be a feeling that, okay, I need to incorporate some path to reintegration as part of any shaming. By that I mean, for example, let's take crime. So, you know, there's various trends of say we get a kid who's shoplifted and they have to wear an orange shirt at the front of a newsagent where they shoplifted. That might have, that's a brief period of stigma. And straight away, there's a plan to get them straight back into school or whatever they were doing, some sort of rehabilitation, get them back into on the path to a more ordinary life. And to be honest, as a doctor, that's exactly what happens. Say I did something especially heinous as a psychiatrist. Say I had a relationship with another patient. Now, I would have punishment. I might be deregistered. But even as part of the deregistration, there would be an automatic path to me returning. Like I say, okay, the next year or two, you're going to do this, 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 and then we'll reconsider you back into the profession. A recognition that, you know, you've got skills and you've transgressed, but ultimately you're still part of this professional group and we want you back. That's an example of a ritual of reintegration. Look, the other aspect I'd say about shame, I think a big factor in mental health at the moment, Lynn, is we're just getting a very limited language in how we speak about human experience. And arguably, my profession is to blame. We've been very successful at reducing stigma, and I'm thrilled about that. And the fact that I can have such a prestigious and in-demand job where you can really impact lives is a tribute to that. But I often do find that people increasingly have a very limited language to describe their experience. And it's often me trying to get people to speak in a less medical language. It's often people, we're trying to shift people from just describing their experience by saying I'm depressed or I'm anxious, when often there's a big moral dimension or there's a metaphysical dimension. And people increasingly lack even the words for this, particularly younger people. And this has actually been borne out in studies too, where they look at younger people, give them moral problems, and increasingly they find they barely have a language to even grapple with them. So I think that's a big factor in mental health disorders at the moment, Lynn, and shame is a big part of that. So often there's the big components of shame, but we don't necessarily even consider that a prospect. And even if we do, it's important that we name it, examine it, and that's when people can overcome it.
Dr. Tanvir Ahmed is a psychiatrist based in Sydney. He's a columnist for the Financial Review newspaper, and his most recent book is called In Defence of Shame. Thanks to All in the Mind's producer, Diane Dean, and today's sound engineer, Marty Peralta. I'm Lynn Malcolm. It's great to have your company. Till next time.